Hey, 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 it's me, Katie here. Grab a notebook and a cuppa and join me in the sociology staff room. Hello, good morning, good afternoon, depending on when you're listening to this. Welcome to the sociology staff room. I'm Katie Tyler and I'm very, very excited to talk to Alison Wiggins today about how we really support our trainees. And I think, you know, not just supporting our trainees through their experience into joining the teaching profession for social sciences, but also something we've just spoken to about off air quickly is also retaining our trainees and keeping them in the profession. I think that's part of our role. We are a big network of sociology teachers, so we want to keep our trainees and want to sort of keep sociology alive. It's a very important subject. So first of all, thank you for devoting some of your time today.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. So before I start, please tell us all about yourself, because I'm sure our audience would love to know a little bit about your background and your current role as well.
Yeah, no problem. So my name is Alison Wiggins. My pronouns are she and her, and I am the subject lead for the Social Science PDC at UCL, the Institute of Education. So everyone used to know it as IOE. I have worked there full time for the last 2 years, but before that, I was a teacher in schools, social science teacher in schools for the last kind of 13, 14 years. So I've worked in 3 schools across London. I started off, I did the GTP, I didn't even do a PGC myself. So I did the GTP, which was the program, the graduate teacher program, where you started teaching the day you arrived. So on the 3rd of September, I started teaching. They gave me a lesson plan, they gave me the resources, and they sent me on my way. And I taught a year 9 PSHE lesson where a boy threw a chair across the classroom. But it wasn't aimed at me. He just said, "Oh, miss, that wasn't for you." And I was like, okay. It was my very, very first day. And my mentor was with me in the room. And I looked at her and she just said, "Deal with it." So I just had to deal with it. And basically that was the pattern of my experience. It was the best experience of my life. So I did my GTP in my training school, and I stayed in my training school and took a tutor group from year 7 all the way through to year 13, which is quite rare now. But when they left, it was either I started again at year 7 and I would have been there for another 7 years, or it was time to move on, so I decided to move on. So I've taken up a number of roles: head of faculty, head of department, head of subject. My specialism is sociology, but I've also managed, I have a real passion for vocational education, so I've managed BTEC health and social care programs, I've taught psychology. So I was in schools having a really good time, and then I was a visiting lecturer at UCL for vocational education and relationships and sex education, which was my specialty. And then I got the opportunity to work kind of part-time at the university. So I did part-time in school, part-time at university for 8 years, which was a really long time. And then eventually took the jump over. So I've had lots of experiences in education, but I came to education quite late. I didn't train to be a teacher until I was 28. And I had another career working in admissions at a university before that. So I've always been in the field of education, but I've been a teacher for about half the time that I've been in education. And now I'm a teacher educator. I'm also an EdD candidate. So we were just talking about PhDs off air. So I'm just starting my doctorate in education, and it's specifically about education and race. I'm also a consultant in anti-racism, and I work for a number of organisations in terms of their education. One of them is the Premier League, and I also work as a facilitator for the School of Sexuality Education. So I still teach in classrooms, which is the best that I still get to do that, because I don't want to just be a lecturer who tells people how to teach but doesn't remember how to do it themselves. So I go across schools all over the country teaching about consent, relationship and sex education, reproductive and sexual health. And then I'm also a school governor, so I can't get enough of education. I'm in it in all the different facets of my life. And it's kind of, yeah, it's, I feel like it's my purpose, the thing that I'm meant to do.
I mean, I can't even say any more than that. I'm like, wow, is the statement I want to say at the end of that. That is literally amazing. I mean, talk about educational spaces. Like, it's literally, I don't know, the word I was thinking, like, it's every, like you said, every facet of education. I think you've sort of, not primary school or nursery at all. I mean,
You know what? My mum ran an after school club at a primary school. So in my university holidays when I was an undergrad, I had to go and work there. So I did also work with really young children. So, yeah, I think that's kind of it. I think you'll find in a lot of teacher families, there's always connections. Your mum, your auntie, someone's kind of done it, or there's been like childcare or anything to do with education. I guess I was kind of socialized into it from quite a young age with my mum. But yeah, I wouldn't even put it like I always say to people, the classroom is the best bit. And lots of people think that when you get to my position and you're a lecturer in university, that you're like sorted. And I'm like, no, the best bit is in the classroom with the young people. And I really envy my student teachers who have the opportunity to do that. And that's the reason why I still teach, because I need to stay connected to the classroom, because the second you're out of the classroom, your skills, everything moves on without you. The only, and this is a piece of like advice someone gave to me when I was training, which is the only constant in teaching is change. The only thing that is constant in teaching is change. So you have to get with change. And I think that's why I found all of these different opportunities and different spaces that I can use my experience, my expertise, but I can also learn from. And I think, yeah, we're obviously going to talk about this, but I think one of the best things you can do as a teacher is take this as an opportunity for learning and for growth for you, as well as for the young people that you're like working with.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I totally echo that. I feel like there's lots of similarities I sort of like hear. And I think I started actually, I did a PGCE post 16, but to get my QTS, I had to do a GTP. And that was definitely a baptism of fire. I forgot, until you said it, I forgot what that actually felt like. Rightly or wrongly, because I was quite naive, I think I had quite an extensive timetable, which potentially may or may not have should have had, but definitely talk about learning on the job very quickly, and like you say, classroom management, you sort of forget, funny, you sort of look at things sometimes through rose-tinted glasses, don't you, and you sort of forget what that's like until you mentioned it. So there's lots I want to talk to you about, and like you said, that sort of idea around growth and development, particularly, not just particularly for the ECTs or the trainees, or also people, I think it's just as true for an experienced teacher. I actually said to my students yesterday, the day that I think I know it all, this is the day I have to stop teaching, because like you said, the constant is change. And I think, because students joked to me, went, are you changing your resources again? And I went, yeah, I think I'll change them again. Like, that's a really good point you made for next year. And they went, will there be a day when your resources will be finished? And I went, no, they won't be, because every student will bring something different to the classroom and something will change in society. And that's the job of a sociology or a teacher, full stop. So yes, definitely. I definitely hear that, what you're saying. So obviously the first part of our conversation is really thinking about trainees initially, and maybe we can talk about ECTs. But obviously something we did speak off there was about teacher retention. And I think we have some teachers still wanting to come into the profession. Just out of interest, how many have you got currently on roll for the PGC cert in social sciences?
Yeah, so I work alongside the PGC in psychology as well at UCL, really, really closely together. And we usually have 20 students on both. But unfortunately, what we've had this year is, first of all, some people who didn't show up. That's never happened before. Like on the first day, they said that they were coming. And we've also had a few people that have had to interrupt for various personal and health reasons. So we're on 15 at the moment out of the 20 that we started with, and that's for kind of both programs. And we have never had any problems recruiting, and I think that's because of our central London location, it's because of our reputation, and it's because of how we are very good at what we do. Like university itself and the Institute of Education has a very, very, very long and successful history of training teachers and is very serious about it. It's not like a sideline. It's kind of our core purpose as an institution. So we've never really had any problems recruiting. And usually by this point, we are closed to applications, but we're not at the moment. So let me say now to everybody who's listening who might want to be a teacher in the future, we're still open. Apply to us. Or talk to us, or come to our open days, and do whatever you want to do to get yourself to a place where you feel like you're ready to do this. So yeah, it has been a really kind of tricky time in terms of recruitment. And I think obviously, and when you look at the political and kind of social landscape that we're experiencing at the moment, we can really clearly see the reasons for that. We're also having, there are obviously less people studying sociology, unfortunately. And we're now thinking about how we adjust our entry requirements to kind of mitigate those kind of issues. So yeah, we're going to have to, like we were just talking about change, we're going to have to change the way we do things in order to make sure that our program is still viable and sustainable in the future. I'm sure that most people will be aware that there was a reaccreditation that happened in initial teacher education and initial teacher training. And we are very fortunate in that we are allowed to train, continue to train teachers from 2024, 25 onwards, but our program has to change. And not every institution was allowed to continue. So the kind of the field of teacher education has narrowed, which means that next year we might not have the same recruitment issues that we've had this year. But unfortunately, the numbers of people applying to do teaching are down across the board. So every institution and every subject. And because sociology and psychology does not come with a bursary, it's even more challenging for people to give up work and try and live in London for a full year on a student loan and with in a cost of living crisis. Like it's becoming increasingly difficult for people. So yeah, we are trying to mitigate that. We're obviously supporting our students as much as we can, and we are trying to make sure that we've got enough students to run our programme. So we do have enough, but we need to make sure that we can kind of, we have to over-recruit just in case people for whatever reason can't come or aren't able to take up their place this year.
Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? It's not just because obviously from the other picture, from the A-level picture, the sociology students are increasing, as in the numbers are taking sociology and psychology. I think from my last look, we were number 5 in the A-levels, whereas before we were sort of down at 9-10. So hopefully that will translate to sort of students taking degrees. I know that about a year ago now, we spoke to Dr. Pereira at Warwick University, and she's the head of the undergraduate for sociology there. And she was saying that there is sort of the engagement is very different at undergraduate level than it was historically. And that might be because of COVID, because of cost of living crisis, and it's very different to what it was, say, when I was doing my degree and in the past sort of thing. So it's interesting around the landscape of education. And I suppose you've got the issue around recruitment, which I suppose if you've got teachers doing sort of a skit or an in-house training course, there's going to be that issue of recruitment there, and obviously for the universities yourself. So I suppose there is that element, but there is also the retention element. So there's sort of that two-fold approach to ensuring that we've got the teachers within the classroom for our students, because ultimately that's the goal, isn't it, that we have the best qualified teachers for the job in hand, but also preserving the mental health of our teachers as well. So I suppose my first question is, from speaking to your trainees at the trainee level, what are their sort of fears and desires and goals around getting into teaching? I suppose maybe if we start with their desires first, like what are their sort of, they're coming in enthusiastic, what are they expecting from us as institutions, whether that's working in a comprehensive, a sixth form college, grammar school, free school, whatever teaching landscape they're in, what are they expecting when they come into the programme, and what are they expecting from the institutions they're placed in?
So that's a really good question. And it's something that I talk about quite a lot. It's kind of people's motivations for teaching. So what is it that you are here for? If you're a graduate, there are many avenues, and all of us had to make a decision, right? So when we graduated, we had to make a decision. What are we going to work for? Are we going to work for a particular purpose, or are we going to work for the love of money? And I remember like very vividly having to make that decision, because I had two jobs available to me. One was to work in a really corporate environment, and the other one was to work in university. And it was a no-brainer for me. Like, I was always going to do a job where I helped people. And initially I really thought about social work, and me and my best friend, we were both thinking about social work and teaching, and he ended up going into social work and I ended up going into teaching, and we're still doing it now. But you have to make a decision, and it's how, you know, to some degree, how attractive teaching is made to the student teachers and for the people who are applying. And that really depends on their context and their own experiences of education. So the main motivating factors when I interview people to come onto the PGC, which I just did last week, there are two main reasons why people decide to come into teaching. One, they had an incredible teacher. They had a teacher that helped them at a time in their life that they were really, really struggling with, or helped them when they didn't believe in themselves and got them to a place where they were able to achieve. And that is probably 80% of people come into teaching because of that. And some of the teachers were like primary school. They weren't necessarily their last teacher or their A-level teacher or their sociology teacher even. I spoke to a young person the other day, and it was their English teacher that changed their life, completely changed their life. And it's really, I get quite emotional when I hear these stories, because that's the magic. That's the bit. That is what we as teachers have the privilege and the opportunity to do, is we can change people's lives. Like, we can actually do things that change the trajectory and the courses of people's lives. And that, to me, is worth all the stress and worth all the difficulty that comes with teaching. There is so much that we have the capacity and the opportunity to do for young people that, you know, and I always think, if it's not me, who is it going to be? And, you know, what is the difference that I make that might be different to the difference that somebody else would make? But all of us make a difference. So that's 80% of people. The other 20% are going into teaching to undo the harm that was done to them through education. And that is really hard. It's hard to hear that young people sometimes have gone through really, really difficult circumstances at school, you know, been excluded, you know, were labelled at school, had a really, really tough time, bullied, like all of these, and they want to be the teacher that they didn't have. And often people who are from minoritized groups fall into this category. So I am very good friends with somebody I trained about 10 years ago. And he is a queer, out and queer teacher, but he became a teacher because he didn't have a teacher who understood and valued and respected him when he was at school. And he thought, he does it for all the queer kids in his school, because he's like, if I have to be that person, because he said he almost didn't survive school. Like, that's how bad it was. So those are the two kind of motivations for teachers. So people do come in very, very clear ambitions about what it is that they want to achieve through teaching. And we just want to nurture that. Like, I want that energy. I need you to come in believing that you're going to make a difference and understanding the value and the purpose of education. And all we do is nurture that. All we do is give you some skills and build you up and give you opportunities and send you on your way and support you through that. So my students have incredible like backstories and journeys to get in here. Not everybody is fresh out of university. And actually, I think some of our strongest student teachers are ones who have had other experiences. We've got parents, we've got people who are neurodiverse, we've got loads and loads. We've got such a beautiful diversity of people. And they all bring something very unique, both to our program, but also absolutely to our students and our young people that they're working with in schools. So they come in with all this energy, they come in with a purpose, and we just don't want that purpose to be beaten out of them by the system. So we really hold on to that. And I think in sociology, like, you have to believe that. You have to have the hope that what you're doing makes a difference. And that is what sustains you. That's definitely what sustained me when I was at school. Because working full time for 13 years in school is really, it's a lot. Like, it's hard. You're not going to find very many teachers in school who've been doing it more than 10 years now. We're like unicorns.
Oh, I'm in my 20th year. I don't know what's happened today. But there we go. Actually, I've got a few greys. There we go.
I think unicorn, because you've been there 20 years. Like, it is, it's so rare. And when I was training, everybody had been there 10 or 20 years. Everyone. Like, there weren't very many new teachers. And I felt really privileged to be a new teacher, because so many people had been in it for a long time, believed in it, and were really positive about it. And that was my first experience, being in a school where people loved what they did. They did not see it as, oh, I'm just here for the holidays and the money. Like, that's not it. And that's not my experience of most people who teach. But, I mean, I'm sure there are some. They're not in my circle, but I'm sure that they are there. And, you know, and you do you. That's absolutely fine. But that isn't what I'm there for. And it wasn't what all of the teachers who I initially worked with were there for. So, yeah, that's what we're working towards.
So, I mean, so clearly said, yeah. And I think, first place, my question is from a sort of someone that might be a head of department or a colleague. How do we nurture? Because I suppose my question is, it's obvious how we nurture, but how do we nurture it? You know, I call it sometimes, I'm sure lots of the teachers call it a five alive day, five period day with a morning duty, a meeting after school, students coming back at lunchtime. How do we give that space? I mean, I know something I've started doing in my school, which is quite, because I've been reflecting about it a lot, just as my personal passion at the moment is keeping good teachers into teaching and empowering them. I just do like a biscuit club on a Thursday. It started off as cake club, but that was going to be way too expensive. And there's no formal meeting, it's just biscuits. Like, it was like, where are these biscuits coming from? I'm like, my own pocket. But it's £2.50. Like, they're cheap biscuits from I won't say a brand, but they're from a place where everything's a pound, basically. And, you know, just to sit there and say, do you want to come and have a biscuit? I know that's something we do. And everyone's like, oh, wow. And I just giving someone a biscuit, literally, like, and a cup of tea is just such a thing. They're like, you're making me a cup of tea. And I'm like, yeah. And like, just even if I can do 5 minutes. But are there any things that the trainers have said that they want to keep that nurturing, that sort of feeling of value, the feeling of that motivation to make a difference? How do we keep that going when we're so time poor? I know, like, you know, dare I say it, you know, I don't, you know, we know that we all haven't got the same 24 hours in a day. You know, I haven't got the same hours as Beyonce, for sure. As I think that's been quoted, look what Beyonce can do in 24 hours, but I haven't got a private chef and I haven't got a chauffeur. So how do we do this in a day?
So I think that when you think about what the student teachers are most concerned with, and then you think about how you address those concerns, if you can. So the main concern that most of our student teachers have is money, because you're not earning anything unless you're working all the hours God sends. So I had a student teacher last year who was working at an airport, and she would leave school on Friday and she would basically stay at this airport all weekend working on bars because she had to live. So money is a really big thing, and I'm really advocating for all the students who don't get a bursary for there to be some financial support for them. They're really worried about workload. They're really worried about progression and how you move around schools in a way that's kind of sustainable, and that you're not, because, you know, unfortunately for my student teachers, a lot of mine fresh out of ECT then straight away become heads of subjects, heads of department, before they're really confident in their own practice, and how you kind of resist the temptation and the, you know, the opportunities usually to, you know, climb the ladder very, very quickly, which is sometimes very unsustainable for people. Like, if you take too much responsibility too soon when you're not secure in your own practice and you haven't developed those relationships with your staff or with your students, that can be really, really tricky. They're worried about, you know, behaviour for learning. They're worried about relationships. They're worried about well-being. And it's all of those kind of things. So if you're, I think, across the board, the most important thing you need to do is listen to the people that you're supporting. So you need to hear what it is that they're saying, and you need to understand what it is that you have the capacity to be able to do to support those things. So if you are a main scale teacher and you are mentoring, for example, you have particular responsibilities, but you have to develop a relationship where those responsibilities are kind of mutual. They have a responsibility to you and to your practice and to the classes that they're covering for you, and you have a responsibility to them. But it's non-hierarchical. And I think what you just said about making someone a cup of tea and a biscuit, it can be life-changing for people, because then they feel like they're being seen and that they're being cared for and nurtured and understood. Everybody needs to sit down and for someone to say to them, is everything all right? And then you give them a cup of tea, you give them a biscuit. I did exactly the same thing when I was head of department, but I would do it with yum yums. And I would bring just yum yums in on a Friday. And that was it. And I didn't do anything other than that. And I didn't even say anything. I just leave them on the side and they'd be gone by the end of the day. And I just know that that made somebody's day a little bit better. So I think that what we need to do as teachers who are nurturing new teachers, ECTs, trainee teachers in schools, is I think we need to be positive about our own and honest about our own journeys and our own difficulties with that. If we just present as if we are perfect and everything is fine and all of our classes, oh, all the kids are good for me, oh, I've done my working already, all of that, which is the way that some people present because that is how they get their confidence, that is really demotivating for student teachers and for new teachers in the profession. So it's about being honest and being real about things. It's about being able to narrate and the journey. And when you get the opportunity to speak to student teachers, you just say, do you know what? A few years ago, and for some of us, it will be more than a few years ago, I experienced this. You know, I did this. This, I really struggled with this. But after a few years, I got there. So it's like modelling the idea of a journey and that this is something that we are learning with the students. We're just not the people teaching them. So that the idea that, you know, this growth, this development is reciprocal. And as you're getting better, the students are getting better. But none of us are perfect, none of us know everything, and we can't know everything, and we've got to be really, really honest about that from the outset with the new teachers, so that they don't feel so exposed and vulnerable, because they obviously don't know everything yet. And I would say be really explicit about what it is that you're doing and the strategies that you've developed over time to be able to navigate those difficulties. I started marking by question 6 or 7 years into my practice. It changed my life. But before that, I was marking every script, like from, you know, you would do it from the front page to the back page, it would kill me. And I, you know, I'd do that thing where I'd take it home and I'd leave it in the bag and then pick it up and bring it back home again. Because
over there.
Yeah, and I would do it all the time. But I had very good mentors. They were able to kind of model that journey for me. They were very clear about boundaries. And I don't think that's something we probably talk about enough in teaching, is creating boundaries for yourself. You know, from through most of my practice, I never took any work home. I was the person who was there at the end of the day. The cleaners were telling me, get out, like, it's time to go now. But I would be there until I'd done as much as I possibly could, but I never took any work home. I had very clear boundaries about what I do in school and what I do outside of school. And that helped to sustain me through it. It doesn't work for everybody, but it definitely worked for me because I didn't have any responsibilities at home. I think it's really important that you, like, model those well-being practices, whether it's sitting down, like, having a break. There are so many teachers who are like, oh no, I'm too busy to eat, I'm too busy to go to the toilet, no. Like, I don't believe that is in any way helping anybody. Sit down, have your break, have your lunch, have a cup of tea if you need to, go to the bathroom when you need to, you don't have to be there at 6 a.m. And you know, when student teachers or new teachers see you doing that, it gives them permission to be able to do it as well. And I just think it's about making sure that you recognize that the teachers are learning from you even when you don't think that they are, because they're watching what you do, and that is creating a template for what it is that they think is the right thing to do. So sometimes the way that you train them and teach them is explicit, but sometimes it's not explicit and they're just learning from what they see you do. And that can be obviously positive or negative. But yeah, I think it's really important to make connections between where you are and where you were and what strategies and support you've needed to get there, because we all need support. There's none of us, you know, even head teachers, they're not working as islands by themselves. Like, all of us need support, all of us have a team behind us. And it's, yeah, modelling that, it's being explicit about it, and it's also being honest and recognising, you know, sometimes you don't get your marking done. No one's going to die. You'll just do it for the next time. You'll just say to your students, you know what, I'm really sorry, I wasn't able to get it done for Thursday, but I'll make sure you get it on Monday. And that's it. So yeah, that's the kind of stuff that I advocate for, and I think that's about the way that mentors conduct themselves and support student teachers, but it's also about everybody in a school who has student teachers or ECTs work in their department or in their kind of sphere of influence, I guess.
So interesting, there's so much in that, but so much it's just pragmatic and practical. It's nothing, it's nothing that's like I don't know, creating some sort of I'm trying to think, like a sort of course within a school, or you know, a sort of a script of a meeting. It's like you said, it's listening, you know, number one, listening and being and seeing that person for what they are, and sometimes just like having a conversation, like the stuff you said about modeling practice and being explicit, showing your vulnerabilities, being honest, and sort of the idea that actually it's sort of like that whole thing around I think Australia did it actually with children, and I see you do, we do sort of thing. I think it was a sort of about parenting, but it's the same, isn't it, with our trainees, that if we're not taking lunch breaks, if we're, you know, working excessive hours and having unrealistic targets for ourselves, then they're going to feel, well, maybe I should be doing that. And actually that's not a healthy space for people to be in. It's interesting because I'm hoping that people who are sociology teachers, and there will be, that are in senior leadership as well. There'll be people that are listening to this, will be head of sixth forms, maybe assistant heads or deputy heads as well. And actually thinking about, well, actually, that's not just something that happens in a department. That's something that you said happens whole school, and thinking about how, what image we have across the school. It might be just something as simple as, like, we have a policy that we are not sending emails. And if we do, because some people have to work outside, like I know personally, I have to work at night because I've got two young children, so I need to be home at a set time. And I do have to work at night. I used to work a bit like how you did pre-children, but then making sure we sort of schedule that email so that someone else hasn't got that in their inbox. So we've done it, but they don't have to see it till like 8 o'clock the next morning. It's all those sort of small things that have that sort of ripple effect that are so important. We spoke at the beginning about retention. What do you think, from your experience working with trainees, and maybe they assume you keep in contact with them once they leave and finish the course, what's the biggest thing that keeps them within the profession, and what's the biggest thing that keeps them out of the profession? Like, what's the biggest thing that causes burnout? I suppose we hear that word a lot, burnout. Mm. And we need to know that so we don't keep on doing that, whether that's intentionally or unintentionally. And also, what's the thing that keeps them in? Like, what keeps them in the school for longer than, I think it's like a 3-year window, isn't it? I can't remember the statistic, but if you're going to leave, you're going to leave in 3 years. So what keeps them longer than 3 years?
Okay, so there's a few things. I think the most successful and the happiest teachers, because one of the things that we do in our program is that I invite teachers back. If you're still in the profession, and we've talked about this, like anyone who's still here and they've got something to share, I will bring them in, and I want them to have the opportunities that I did, to be a guest lecturer in a university and to share what they have learned with the new generation of teachers. I think that is so important. So the people who are happiest and most successful in school, when they're in schools, are those who work flexibly. So there's a level of flexibility that is allowed in the school. That's why people often, you know, you said you worked in further education briefly, and most sociology and psychology teachers are often, the bulk of their timetable is Key Stage 5. So they might be working in a sixth form exclusively or a sixth form college. And that allows for a level of flexibility that you don't get in lots of places. Things like working in schools that are led in a way that's inclusive and equitable is really important. So part of the work that I'm doing for my doctorate is looking at retention of teachers based on issues of equity. And obviously, we know that people who are from minoritized groups, particularly those who are racially minoritized, have a lot, that their retention levels are a lot less than white teachers. So it's about the degree to which you're recognizing that not every teacher is experiencing the school in the same way. So schools that are explicitly anti-racist, that are explicitly inclusive of different gender identities or sexualities or religions and all of those kind of things, but that is part of the fabric and the ethos of the school. Those are the schools that our student teachers stay in. Our student teachers who have, you know, developed like positive well-being practices and strategies can have set those boundaries. Like, I love what you said about the emails. I'm very explicit and very clear about that. I will answer my emails between 9 and 5. I'm not doing it outside of that, and definitely not at weekends. But if you send your emails, that's fine. Just know that my turnaround is usually 48 hours. I don't think that educators should be on their emails 24 hours a day, and I don't have the capacity to be able to do that. But I'm really clear about it. So having clear boundaries, and also having parts of your job that go beyond sometimes your role as a classroom teacher. So one of my students just got a job yesterday, actually, and her part of her role is that she's going to have a responsibility for volunteering, because that's something she cares so much about. One of my student teachers, student teachers, has now started her own kind of support company for Black and minoritized teachers called Black Teachers Connect. And she's doing incredible work, and that's sustaining her as well. So having interest and being able to use your expertise in different ways is another way that sustains you, because it helps you, again, connect to your purpose. And also, you know, supportive environments where they're growing you, they're nourishing you, they're not just giving you more responsibility. They're saying, you know, do you want to do a master's? Do you want to undertake some training here? Is this something you're interested in? And there's a level of flexibility. And again, it's like the school is listening to you, and they're responding to what it is that you need, not fitting you into the agenda that they already have. And those seem to be the students who are happiest and doing well. And also, again, recognizing that, you know, your first school might not be the school that you are in forever. And sometimes I say to the students, it's not teaching that you don't like, it's the school. So move the school and then you'll love teaching again, hopefully. But sometimes it is about being confident enough to make the jump when you recognise that it's not working for you, or there's a misalignment between your values and the values of the school, and recognising that you need to move, you don't need to give up. And lots of my students, you know, they come to me for advice long after they've left the university. And that's often what I have to say to them. I was like, well, everything you're saying tells me that this is not working for you. And if it's not working for you, you have to leave. And I know that's hard and I know it's scary, but you have to do that. Otherwise, you'll leave the profession rather than leaving the school. And I think that that's something we really need to be aware of. And then I think, schools have a responsibility to work with teachers. And I know that sounds obvious, but sometimes hierarchies are very much kind of like top down. and they're not really listening to the people who are working with them and putting all the hours God sends in and dealing day to day with all the issues that they're facing. And they're not really listening. So I think schools where they've got like kind of democratic management structures are also the schools that are able to maintain their workforce for a longer period of time. And I remember reading in the NEU magazine about a school where no one leaves. It's in Bethnal Green. It's a primary school. No one leaves. No one leaves, no one comes. It's just completely stable because everybody is so happy there. And they're so happy there because they feel like their decision-making, their needs are included in what the school's needs are. It's not the school's needs are here and you have to fit yourself or slot yourself into them. It's that those two things together are what make the school the incredible place it is to work. So yeah, that's what I think is needed to make sure that we can retain our teachers and that we can make this profession something that is sustainable. Like, we want people to be in here for the long haul. You pay all this money. Like, when I trained to be a teacher, I'm sure when you did, we didn't have to pay for our course. So not only are we asking people to pay £9,500 for a program on top of all the debt they've already got from their undergraduate degree, but we're also, you know, in some ways asking them to sacrifice their mental and physical health for it. And that's not sustainable and it's not right. Like, we have to do, we have to have an education system that works for both the teachers and the students, not just the students or the school structures.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think the thing is, it's like you just said at the end, it's if you nourish, you talked about the word nourish, that's sort of a word that came out in my head when you were speaking, but it's this idea that if we have teachers that feel nourished and their well-being is looked after, that's only going to have a positive impact on the students. So all the stakeholders who are involved are actually happy at the end of it. So sort of that saying, it's more like a parental saying, but happy mum, happy baby. It's the same for, you know, in education, happy teacher, happy students, happy students, mm-hmm. happy teacher. You know, and I think there's lots of things on different levels that people can be accountable for to ensure our teachers stay within the profession. Like you said, it can be having more democratic structure within the school, but it's also that idea of listening. And sometimes the temptation, I think, is to give people responsibilities, but actually, is that really what they want? And if we listen to them properly, then we might not be giving them the right thing. And we've sort of covered so many important points. And I think for some people, I sometimes think as well, just a real simple thing is, if there are people that are listening as well that are in positions of responsibility, is remember what it felt like to be a trainee teacher, I think, and just remember what that felt like and what you wanted out of it, and all the anxiety that you had as a teacher. I think that's such a place to sort of come from, because I think sometimes we get on that treadmill of, we've got to do this, we've got to do this, et cetera, et cetera. Before we know it, we've lost sight of what we actually have to do rather than what we need to do. There's like a sort of a difference of what we should be doing and what we really need to be doing, and sort of deciding which bit's important for us. But yeah, I think there's so much that on each level we can do, and it doesn't have to be massive. I think it comes back to that sort of debate around, well, not supposed to debate, but how do we create teacher agency within the structure, and how we do that? Because ultimately, you know, we're not in positions of government where we're changing the curriculum, but what can we do within the classroom? I'd love to know your thoughts actually quickly, just before we leave. I know that, like I said, it's supposed to be a short period of time, but you've just such a wealth of knowledge. I could talk to you all day, and I realise that, like, you've probably got things to do. My last question is, how can teachers themselves, and I know we're not now, not just trained teachers, but there's a lot around teacher agency and teacher autonomy, and that's very much linked to wellbeing and retention. And I know I'm putting you on the spot as a question, but how as teachers can we create that sense of agency ourselves in what feels sometimes a structure where we haven't got that agency? Or do you think that's important to have teacher agency?
Well, I don't know, and teacher autonomy. It's something we should have said right from the beginning, that agency and autonomy and trust is so important. If you feel like your management team and your department trust you, that helps to alleviate so much of the anxiety that comes from teaching, because you always want to be doing your best. And that's an impossible standard to hold yourself and other people to. So when you feel like you are trusted as a professional, and you don't have to be micromanaged, you don't have to have every second of your day planned out, and your leadership team can leave things with you and trust that if something's going to be tricky or like not possible, whatever, that you'll come to them before you know, it gets to a point where, you know, it's too late and everything's kind of crumbling. So I think in terms of agency, it's something that you have to be very deliberate about. Unless you are able, you have the confidence and the motivation to be able to kind of speak back sometimes and to speak up for yourself and for your students, you can get kind of bogged down and swallowed by organizational structures and by the assumptions that you have to do things a certain way because other people do it that way. You have to develop a level of, you know, a professional identity about that's based on your expertise and your knowledge and your subject, and in the young people that you work with, because you have to know your subject really well, but you also have to know your young people really well. And you have to have the capacity and be intentional about building those relationships. And I think that's the relationships is where the agency can come. Because if you have positive relationships with your classes, then you can take more risks with them, which means that your teaching is going to be more innovative and your pedagogies are going to be more creative. And if you've got that relationship and you can see that, you know, you're meeting the outcomes that your school, you know, unfortunately, because of the assessment structures, there are things that we are going to be held accountable for. But how you do that is entirely up to you. And I think creating an inclusive and equity-centered classroom, and one that is based on communities of learning rather than, you know, hierarchies where I'm the teacher and you're the student, you listen to me. I think that is where you can have agency, but also your students can as well. And that creates a classroom where everybody is learning together. And that always feels different to a classroom where people are silently doing their work and the teacher is at the front checking their emails. And I'm not, there's no shade on anybody who does that. No shade whatsoever. We all have to do that at some point. But it's about recognizing that within your classroom and within your subject, you have choices, and you need to be aware of the choices that you and the opportunities that you have within your subject and within your classroom. And you only do that by reaching out to other people. Like, you need to keep observing other people's practice. You need to engage with things like this, like the podcast, and you need to keep learning so that you're, you know, like you said, you're constantly updating your resources, you're constantly changing things on the basis of feedback you get from your students and AFL that you're doing with them. And that means that you are always growing, and with that growth comes confidence, and with confidence comes agency.
Oh, I feel like that is it. I'm not going to say any more to that. Perfect. Thank you. I feel like there's almost another conversation. Maybe I'll get you in the future, because I appreciate you're quite busy with students coming to the end of their academic year. But about how we create equity within the classroom, because I think you mentioned that'd be really interesting to explore that. I know that's a passion of yours as well, and I think that's really important. I think particularly for sociology teachers, where we have to talk about and we want to talk about things around equitability and equality and the differences in stratification. But how do we talk about it in a curriculum? But also, how do we do it in practice? I think that'd be a really interesting conversation to have. But yes, thank you. I don't even know what else to say than thank you. It's amazing. I love listening to you. You've got a wealth of knowledge. And if you've got people you know, because I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast, you're already a teacher or you're training to be a teacher. But if you know anyone that is thinking about it, it might be a learning support assistant that you're working with in the classroom, or a TA who's like, oh, I'd like to go, maybe send them this podcast and link to the Institute of Education's website as well, because we all know a really great learning support assistant that should really be a teacher, the unsung heroes in the classroom. But thank you for your time, and I really, really appreciate it. I wish I could work with you. Like, you're such an amazing teacher. Like, I wish I was your, like, head of department or faculty. I bet you're fantastic when you're in the classroom. So thank you ever so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Have a lovely day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
A Sociology Staff Room is brought to you by Tutor2U Sociology. Find us at tutor2u.net/sociology, or follow us on Twitter at Tutor2USoc or Instagram at Tutor2USoc. You can also join our very lively Facebook groups for sociology teachers. See you soon.